Have the labels that society and others have applied to you seemed limited? Have people tried to put you in a box because of how you look or where you're from? Have you ever thought about how your personal identity has shaped your approach to leadership? Then I'm sure you will enjoy my conversation with Joel Alvarado.
Welcome to the Empowerment Zone with Ramona Houston, where we zone in on Black and Brown relations and our journey to empowering our communities.
As a Puerto Rican from New York, Joel defines himself as so much more. In this interview, Joel discusses his personal evolution and how, through every phase of his life, he has learned to embrace all of who he is. An Afro-Latino, first-generation college graduate whose career is predicated on social and economic justice, equity, movement work, and transformative leadership, Joel defines himself. Currently, Joel is Vice President of Strategy and Engagement at the Partnership for Southern Equity. Hi, Joel. Welcome to the Empowerment Zone.
Hey, Ramona, how you doing? Thank you for the invitation.
Man, I'm excited to have you. You've been on my list for a while, and I'm so happy that you accepted my invitation to be on the show.
Well, I'm honored and humbled that you asked. And, you know, I'm always eager to have meaningful conversations with people who are doing good work in communities that need that good work to happen.
Well, thank you so much. I'm really interested in the topic that you have chosen today, looking at Afro-Latinidad or Afro-Latino identity in the South and exploring that experience. You know, I'm from Texas. I'm an African-American, but I grew up with a strong relationship with the Mexican-American community, so much so that I identify myself as bicultural in terms of that component of myself of having the Mexican-American experience tied into the African-American experience. And coming to Atlanta, it's been very interesting to view how Atlanta looks at everything in terms of Black and white. And I have seen the growth of the Latino community in Atlanta since the early 1990s prior to the Olympics and this big influx of Mexican Americans into Atlanta as a result of needing labor for the Olympics for construction, and how Atlanta has had a challenging time, and the South in general, really, challenging time with the growth of the Latino community in the South. So tell me your experience being Puerto Ricano in Atlanta in the South, and how you view this whole experience.
Well, I've been in Atlanta and in the South since 1991, but I came down from New York City to go to Morehouse College. And, you know, growing up in New York, in retrospect, I realized I grew up in a very diverse neighborhood in Bushwick in Brooklyn, New York. And it was diverse, not because there were white people there, but it was diverse because there were so many different Black and Brown people from so many different parts of the world, right? And so I would live on a block and you would have African-Americans, South Iranians, you would have Dominicans, you would have Jamaicans, Haitians, Ecuadorians, just a whole host of people. And I went to Catholic school as well. And just having all these different communities together, forming one larger community, I was just really blessed. And I didn't realize it at the time, but, you know, looking back, I'm like, it was an incredible opportunity just to learn and grow and to really appreciate other cultures, right, at such an early age, as we just, you know, enjoyed each other's company and the uniqueness that we each brought to our relationships. And so, you know, my journey is pretty interesting. You know, growing up in New York, you know, my mom went to high school. Both my parents were Puerto Rico, of course. I came here at a different time. My mom came when she was six, my dad when he was 16. And my mom, you know, graduated from high school, went directly to work. She wanted to go to college and would have been eligible to go to college, but she didn't realize she could work and go to college at the same time. So it's, you know, the challenges that a lot of first gens just, I don't know, and there's nobody guiding you and helping you. So you make a decision that will have a lifetime impact. I believe my mother could have done very well in college, and who knows what career she could have, that could have led her into, right? But she ended up having a decent career working for New York Telephone in middle management. But again, she didn't get to realize the full breadth and scope of her potential because she didn't get to go to college. My dad is from what you call the campos in Puerto Rico, right? He's from Santa Isabel, which is in the south, sort of like the southwestern part of the island. And my grandfather was a pig farmer. And my dad, he grew up poor. And so that's why he came when he was 16 in order to work, in order to help his family and to not be a burden to his family, but to go out and try to find gainful employment. And my dad never went to high school. And he fortunately was able to find a good union job as an elevator operator. And he worked that for like 40 years of his life.
Wow.
And was able to provide him a livable salary, benefits, retirement, and be able to contribute to his household, even though he didn't have, education beyond middle school. And so, which is one of the reasons I'm always deeply supportive of unions, because they give people like my dad a chance to earn a salary and to live a life that, if not for unions, they may not be able to enjoy. Right?
So true.
To help people move to the middle class who may not have the education or other resources to do so, right? But they have great work ethic, and they have a mind to work.
Yep.
They just need people to represent their interests. So I'm always supportive of the unions. But in any way, my journey really began around 6 years old, sort of a self-identity. We were planning going on a trip to Puerto Rico, and my mother's, one day she had a conversation with me before we left. She said, "Joel, let me talk to you a second." I said, I asked her what it was, and she explained to me that my grandmother looks different than we do. She's a lot darker than we are.
Mm-hmm.
And she was telling me this because she didn't want me to blurt out anything or make any comments about her, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which I found odd. And, even I said, like, why would I do that? But like, okay, I'm not going to argue with you, but that's fine. And so we went to my dad's hometown, and I saw my grandmother, grandfather, aunts and uncles, cousins, and, they were Black. I mean, not my grandfather. He was more, he looks like a typical jíbaro, right? Like a jíbaro is in Puerto Rico is a person who is African, indigenous, and European, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they got this red, ruddy color going on. And that was definitely my grandfather. But my grandmother was very much a Black woman. My father's brothers and sisters were very much Black. My cousins were very much Black. His cousins were definitely Black. And I just noticed that, I had a lot of Black friends in New York. So I'm just noticing, I'm doing in my mind a comparative. I'm looking at them. I'm looking at my friends in New York who are African-American or Jamaican or Haitian. I'm like, wow, they look like these folks I know back home.
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay. And so it wasn't until I got into high school and I started just reading a little more, talking a little more, and I started thinking a little more. I was not a stellar student in high school. I've always been smart, but just not really, what's the word I'm looking for? Dedicated to education. I was more dedicated to basketball, clothes, and girls. And the priority changed every day, right? And I figured out that if I got a 75 in high school, that was high enough where my parents didn't bother me and educate and teachers didn't bother me, and where I do the least amount of work, right? So that's how dedicated I was to education. And so in any event, I started, when I was in high school, I hung out. It's funny you talk about how in Atlanta it's very binary, right? In Georgia, in the South, it's very binary, right? Black and white. In high school, you remember high school, how it's very cliquish. You have all these different groups, right? And so you just sort of gravitate to the group that you think is most representative of who you are and what you enjoy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we have some sort of cultural affinity with. Well, I gravitate to the African-American. And so all my friends were African-American. That's who I hung out with. more times than not, I was the only Puerto Rican amongst them, but they saw me as equal. They didn't treat me any different. And we were all, you know, brothers, you know, that just hung out, played basketball, and all liked the same things. But it had me thinking back to when I was six again and saying, I'm looking at my friends and I'm reminiscing about my family in Puerto Rico. And I'm like, if my family looks like my friends and my friends are Black, then my family's Black. And if my family's Black, what does that make me? Who am I? Right? I must be Black too. Now, just because I might not look as phenotypically Black as my cousins, doesn't make me any less Black. Right? And so I started really thinking about that. And then I started really embracing the fact that I'm Black too, right? And but the problem is, when at the time, as a teenager, what I didn't have was the language, the theory to be able to fully express who I am. I didn't know about intersectionality, right?
Correct.
I didn't know about other terms that and concepts that I can use to better articulate who I am as a human being and be able to not position myself where I have to choose between one or the other, but I can live my life as an and statement, right? Mm-hmm. Not as an or statement. Mm-hmm. And so at the time, I basically just sort of lived my life as an African-American. That was the culture and identity that I had and everything. I was very much comfortable in that space, right? And also part because I had very little knowledge of what it meant to be Puerto Rican, which I find really ironic because I'm growing up in Brooklyn, New York, in a very large and Latino population. But that doesn't mean that you learn to be Latino by osmosis, right? It's not like just because I live amongst Puerto Ricans, I'm going to learn how to be Puerto Rican. I mean, it's more to that, right? Culture is complex, and the transmission of culture is more complex than that. And part of it, I think, is because my parents made a conscious decision to not teach me Spanish and to just have me grow up speaking English only. They did that because they saw my cousins were a little older than me. They grew up in a household where they spoke Spanish. And then when they transitioned to go to school, they had real challenges regarding language. Mm-hmm. And I think that made my mother fearful. She didn't want me to have to experience those types of challenges. Mm-hmm. So they made an agreement that I would just learn English and would not learn Spanish. And I understand the rationale, being the parent now, the decisions you make. I think in retrospect, I wish that they did not make that decision because I feel like I lost so much in learning how to speak Spanish. Mm-hmm. And so, especially it's been both my parents spoke Spanish fluently, right? Mm-hmm. Especially my father, who that man has been living, like I said, since he was 16. He's like, oh, my dad, like 74 now. Mm-hmm. He's been living in the United States, and he still has the thickest accent you would ever find in America, right? He's not giving up his Spanish for anyone, right? And so I could have learned the language so easily, right? Mm-hmm. And I could have done both. But I understand the fears that my mother had, and she didn't want me to be stigmatized or to have any educational challenges. So I understand her rationale, especially being a parent now. So nonetheless, you know, going through, as I get older and I start to leave high school, you know, I find myself wanting to learn more about who I am, but more from an African-American perspective, as a Black male perspective, right? So I read Autobiography of Malcolm X. I read Man-Child of the Promised Land. I read, I read books on African-American history and culture. I read, books about African civilization. So I'm really leaning into exploring who I am as a Black man. And I also, I'm going through this phase where I wasn't even thinking about going to college. I had no aspirations of going to college, but through positive peer pressure on my friends and teachers in my life, they said, Joel, you're too smart to not go to college. You have to go to college. So I enrolled at Borough Manhattan Community College, and there I started taking history courses. for some reason, I had this idea. I wanted to be an engineer. I don't know where that emerged from. I think the premise was that I wanted to build things and develop in countries that they didn't have. Like I wanted to give, I wanted to be a servant to people. I thought being an engineer, I could do that. But for some reason I was not remembering that I'm not the best mathematician. So I don't know what I was thinking about regarding that. But I was taking a lot of history courses and I was very good at that. And I really enjoyed studying the past because I understood that the past offers context to your present and a roadmap to your future. I understood that we operate in a continuum and I understand the importance of history. So I loved immersing myself in history and just reading about it, writing about it, discussing it. So eventually I went from BMCC to Queens College, and that was the first time in my life I truly felt like a minority. I was minoritized there. And it really, I was not ready for, I didn't have the skill set and sort of the self-confidence and knowledge of self to be able to stand tall in a sea of white people like that. It was just really, it was my first time being a PWI and being, you know, amongst all these white people. And I just really, I found myself relegated always to the Black Student Union. So here I am paying all this money to go to this college, and I end up being in one room every day because that was the only place I felt comfortable, I felt seen, and I felt appreciated, right? And it just, so thank God. And also during this time, when I was a janitor at the World Trade Center. And so I was literally cleaning toilets, sweeping floors, mopping floors, throwing out trash. But I realized that I could do more and be more given the chance. So fortunately, I went to Lincoln Center. There was a college fair. I met a man named Dean Sterling Hudson. He was the Dean of Admissions at Morehouse College. And I shared my heart with him about how I wanted to, a chance to be able to show what I can do and just poured out whatever was inside of me, just made a plea for my life. And he looked at me and said, Joe, let me tell you something. You have something in you that you don't even see in yourself. And I believe Morehouse is the only institution that can pull it off. And he accepted me on the spot right there, no questions asked. And that changed my trajectory. It changed my life, where I'm here talking to you today because that man saw something in me that I didn't see in myself. And he was willing to bet on me. Even though I was a diamond in a rough, I might not have been a diamond. I might have been a piece of gold with maybe a little bit of shimmering light coming out of it that he could see, but I hadn't been fully formed diamond yet, right?
You know, when you talk about Dean Hudson of Morehouse College, I mean, that is just an incredible story about how one person can change the trajectory of someone's life. And the importance of education and for you to end up having the opportunity to be at such a distinguished institution as Morehouse College, and Morehouse College being a place where you could really blossom. Like you said, you didn't know your potential, but Dean Hudson could see the potential in you. Props to Dean Hudson.
Absolutely. There's another individual I have to lift up too, Mr. Philip Mott. He passed away last year. He was extremely influential. He was an English teacher at Murray Bertram High School where I went to for my sophomore and junior year. He introduced me to so much phenomenal literature, you know, Baldwin and Haley and Douglas and just so many authors that I was able to read and just appreciate. And he introduced me to Dr. King and Kingian philosophy. He's a second cousin to the King family and to the King siblings. And because of him, I was able, in 1985, I was able to recite one of Dr. King's speeches before Coretta Scott King with some other students.
That's it. And I'm so glad you said it. It's important to say their names and recognize these individuals who make so much of an impact in our lives individually. You know, educators don't get the props that they need to get in terms of changing.
This what this brother did beyond just that, right? He helped convince me to go to college, right? But then one day he saw me working as a working in the World Trade Center as a janitor. And I saw him and I said hello to him. He ignored me, right? He tried his best to act like he didn't see me. And he told me later the reason why he didn't say anything to me because he was so hurt seeing me like that. Yeah. Like the last thing he expected of me was to be in that situation, right? He expected so much more. So when I found out I got into Morehouse, I called him. And for those who are listening, you know, I had to like go through the yellow pages. I had to call on the landline. Some of you may not realize what those are. You might want to Google what a yellow pages is and what a landline is. But I had to, you know, go through some effort to find him, right? So I called him. I told him I got accepted to Morehouse, that I wanted to get a reference from him. Not only did he agree, but he said, and I told him I had to go down to Atlanta to do my interview. He said he'll go down with me. He said,
"That's
schedule the, and this is like 2 years after I graduated from high school, right? Actually, 3 years after I graduated from high school. And so he said, go ahead and schedule your interview around King Week because I'm going down for King Week and I'll go down with you and I'll take you through everything you need in regard to King Week. And so I went down with him during King Week and he had me stay in Yolanda King's house, the eldest daughter of Dr. King. He took me to events and dinners, introduced me to people. I sat in on a meeting on a talk with young people with Reverend James Orange. I mean, it was just a phenomenal experience. And he drove me to Morehouse and sat in the room with me when I had my formal interview. So he was there when I got officially accepted to Morehouse College. So that's why I always lift his name up, because not only did he have an indelible impact on my life when I was in high school, but his willingness to go out of his way to take care of me, to guide me, to help get me to a point where I can start beginning to really understand my potential and really start using the gifts that God gave me in a meaningful way. And so I will always be indebted to that man. And I honor him as much as I can, because teachers matter. And if not for him and not for Sterling Hudson, again, they wouldn't have put me in a position where I can grow and I could realize who I am and what I can possibly become as a human being, as a man in this country that we live in.
Teachers matter so much. I was fortunate to have some great teachers as well. And my third grade teacher, Miss Bobby Nuss, came to my dissertation defense.
Wow.
You know, and that was big for me. And shout out to Reverend James Orange. That's one of my mentors while I was in undergraduate school. So yes, teachers matter, and we thank them for their efforts. And those little small, those things that they consider small are big to us, right?
Big, huge. It's like, you know, like somebody being seen, you know, it's becoming kind of cliche when people say that, like, I see you, but there's some real resonance to that statement in certain contexts, like where you can go, you know, well, you know, Invisible Man is a seminal work, right? Ellison was talking about how we can go through life and not being seen, and really, and not that a person doesn't see you, but they don't see your authentic self, who you really are, right? Mm-hmm. They see what they want to see, a caricature that benefits that person or those people. They want to make you into something that will benefit them, so that their actions towards you, they feel comfortable in whatever they do, whatever harm they cause you, whatever they benefit, they approve that harm. They feel justified in doing so because of the caricature or whatever they define you to be. So anyway, kind of going back to start Morehouse, and Morehouse was definitely a significant phase in sort of my evolution, thinking about who I am and being Afro-Latino, because what it did was it's allowed me the spaces to grow, which I find it really ironic. Like I told people all the time, it wasn't until I got to Morehouse where I started really appreciating, understanding my being Latino, right? Because part of it is because of history, being a history major and just learning history and learning about how I came to be as a person. I'm Afro-Latino in this current state, but there's a history of how I got, how I became who I am as a human being, right? There's a process that led to me becoming, coming into existence, right? At a certain time in human history, you know, in the Western Hemisphere, people like me did not exist, right? But do the interaction, forced interaction between Europeans, indigenous people, and Africans that were transported over here through the slave trade, you know, people like me emerged, right? And so I started going deep into just understanding the history of being Black in Puerto Rico, right? What was slavery like in Puerto Rico, right? Who were some African people of African ancestry from Puerto Rico who were prominent, right? Like Jose Campeche is an artist of renown during colonial times, you know, who was a mulatto, right? You know, Ramon Betance was a doctor who was trained in France, who was an abolitionist, who fought in the Grito de Lares for the liberation of Puerto Rico, who did everything he could in order to try to liberate Black people who were enslaved on the island. You know, Pedro Albizu Campos, right? El Maestro, he was the father of the Puerto Rican nationalist movement, Harvard educated lawyer, friend of Du Bois, a Black man who had a position of leadership in the community, right? And on the island, you had Celso Barbosa, who was an educated man from University of Michigan, who was an Afro-Latino, who was part of the group of Puerto Ricans that was trying to figure out what their reality is going to be after the 1898 Paris Treaty that ceded Puerto Rico to the United States, along with Guam and the Philippines and Cuba for about a year. And so he was part of the group of Puerto Ricans that were trying to figure out what their reality was going to be. So I was just immersing myself, Ramona, and just really trying to understand what it means to be Black and Latino, and really starting to develop this idea that I can tell people confidently that I'm both Black and Latino, right?
Yep.
That I'm not going to allow myself to be caught up in sort of this binary conversation, right? Because it doesn't do me any good, right? If I become a part of the Black community in that binary, what's the definition of Blackness that I have to ascribe to? Can I be who I want to be as a Black man? Or do I have to be what is prevailing regarding how people define Blackness in that in that group, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I just went through the whole process. Just, you know, but you understand that, you know, you go to HBCU, there's so much culture, there's so much history.
It's so much diversity.
Much diversity. For real. Matter of fact, let me tell you this story. It's so funny. I remember the late Maynard Jackson. I was working in DeKalb County in government there. And so he's there and we're talking. And he said, Joel, did you know that in the 1950s, when he was at Morehouse, he said the maroon tiger sharks, the swim and dive team, he said the majority of them were Puerto Ricans from New York, right? And so for some, I don't know how we got to the point where he shared that with me, but I found that as incredible bit of history that I did not know, that this idea of Afro-Latinos attending HBCUs is not a new concept. He was explaining to me that 50, 60 years ago, you had Puerto Ricans who believed that attending an HBCU was in their best interest, that they can go there and feel very comfortable and be a part of that community. And so they just gave me a sense of pride and realization that I'm not alone in my journey, that there are others like me who are both Latino and Black, and realize that HBCUs is as welcoming and as enriching and as nurturing for me as it is for them. And so,
yep, even Tuskegee has School of Veterinary Medicine also had a large group of Cubans and Puerto Ricans to attend their school as early as 50 years ago, too. So this is a history that, like you said, has not been told about historically Black colleges and universities.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so, you know, the work I'm doing is more applied research, looking at phenomena in its current state. But I think that more historical work has to be done regarding this to help build some context to be able to say that there is a history, because you, as a historian, you well know that people don't believe there's a history until somebody puts it on paper, right? And so we need for folks to put it on paper and say, you know, there are lived stories of people throughout the United States of regarding the HBCUs of Latinos attending and having incredible experiences, enriching experiences, and contributing to the culture and contributing to sort of the, to what makes HBCUs so unique and so special, right? So
let me ask you this. What would you say, you know, because all of us go through our own personal development in terms of how we identify ourselves. You know, I've been through it, you know, in terms of claiming my Mexican-ness, if you will, along with the African, being African-American. And you talked about intersectionality. Mm-hmm. If you were speaking to others about having these multiple identities, you talked about your various stages of your lives mm-hmm. that helped you to develop your identity. Correct. What would you say to those individuals, particularly young people, as they explore who they are and attempt to define who they are and embrace all that they are without having to be, like you said, binary, and having to choose how they identify in certain environments?
Well, what I would say to them is, I think this is just a true statement, regardless if it's race or sexual identity or gender identity, what have you, you know, be honest with yourself. Hmm. If you realize who you are and be that in the world, right? And because that is how you're going to live a powerful life, right? When you have to hide who you are as a human being, that means you're hiding a part of you. You're hiding a part of you that makes you who you are. So it's like trying to fight someone with one arm behind your back. You're putting yourself at a disadvantage. But part of being able to live your truth is really learning what that truth is, learning who you are. You got to do the work. You got to don't come out here talking about I'm Afro-Latino, but not taking the time to study what that means. Mm-hmm. Pick up a book. You know, learn about your history, learn about your culture, learn about, you know, that which makes you who you are. Learn about those people who have taken the time to express on paper, you know, or in video or whatever medium you can think of, would express what our reality is like, right? And then what you do is once you get an understanding of who you are and turn the due diligence of finding out what that means, find community, right? There, you're not alone. It doesn't have to be a solitary journey. Find people like you who recognize that there are layers to who they are, right? That they're not just one thing, that there are various components within them that are part of what identifies them as a human being. And so find other people who see the world like you do, who are seen in the world like you're seen, right? And who are looking for ways to express to the world who they are as human beings, but find ways to express their humanity in the realest of terms. And I believe that that's happening. It's funny, I'm just in preparation for this podcast, I'm just kind of doing some brief research. And there's a really good article that came out like in early May from the Pew Research Center. And they did some research. The census, well, let me back up. The census talked about how there was a significant increase in Latinos who self-identify as Black, right? And I think it went from like a million in 2010 to like maybe 2 to 3 million in a span of 10 years. But the research, the methodology that was applied by Pew, they said that there's about 6 million U.S. adults that identify as Afro-Latino, right? And a lot of them are either Mexican, or a lot of them are Cuban, Dominican, or Puerto Rican, right? And especially Puerto Ricans. And what I find interesting is kind of, you know, I've had a journey where I've had to really explore internally and externally sort of who I am as a person, right? And I came to a point once I had language and I had concepts and ideas to be able to fully express who I am, to be able to say authoritatively and confidently that I'm Black and Latino, right? And that I'm a Puerto Rican, but in being Puerto Rican doesn't negate me being Black, and me being saying I'm Black doesn't negate me being Puerto Rican. I'm 51, 52, and really now is when people are fully embracing this conversation. That there's been such a boom in opportunities for me to be able to have meaningful conversations like I'm having with you about it. And so I appreciate those chances to do that. And I hope for the opportunity where people don't see me as a different or an anomaly, but they see me as a human being like anybody else that's normal in the fabric of life that we live every day.
I'm a big advocate for higher education, and I know you are too. Could you give all of those people out there who want to attend college or who are in college a strategy for college success? And can you begin by telling us what college or colleges did you attend? And I know you're in college now. And what were your major or majors? And what strategy would you give a student to ensure that they're successful in college?
I started off at Bermahat Community College. Then I went to Queens College. Then I graduated from Morehouse College with a BA in history. And then I graduated from Clarkland University with a master's in public administration with a concentration in public policy. I'm currently pursuing my doctorate in higher education administration with the hopes of one day becoming a college president from the University of Alabama, focusing on Afro-Latinos in HBCUs, particularly the Atlanta University Center. And so what I would tell people who are, especially first gens, who don't have the educational capital at home to help guide them, like my son doesn't have to worry. He has two parents who can guide him through the education maze, right? Higher education maze. But for those many who, like myself and my wife, who didn't have people like that, I would say that one, persistence is key, right? You have to, sometimes you're going through the process of getting education. There's a lot of stops and starts. And sometimes you might not see the light at the end of the tunnel, but you have to keep moving forward. Because Ramona, I should have easily, any statistic, as you know, education, any statistic you want to use, I shouldn't even be where I'm at right now, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The fact that my parents didn't go to college, the fact that I went to all these different colleges, the fact that I failed 2 to 3 entrance tests to the community college, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Any statistic you can think of, I should have long dropped out. But, you know, thank God I had God and I had a belief in myself where I kept moving forward, right? So one, persistence is key. Do not quit on yourself. Two, go to college, get an education, so that way you can find a career where you can intersect your profession with your passion, right? Don't go to college to get a job. Go to college in order to find a career where you can make a difference, where you can wake up in the morning and feel happy about what it is that you're doing. Me, I work for a social justice organization where I am a vice president for strategy engagement, and we fight in order to end structural racism in American South and to push a racial equity agenda. That gives me joy. That makes me happy, and I'm glad I can intersect my profession with my passion. And the last thing I would say is take the time to develop yourself while you're in college. It is a phenomenal time in a person's life to be in college. Everything is new, all these ideas, all these just so much just is revealed to you when you're in college. Fully enjoy that experience, right? And take the time to develop yourself as a human being, because who you become at the end of your 4 years in college or however long you take to get your degree or beyond that it's not only going to be determined by what you learn in the classroom, but also what you learn outside the classroom. So take the time to put enough energy in learning outside the classroom as you do inside the classroom, because you'll find out that they are compatible and that they will make you make your experience much more richer and more fulfilling.
Love that advice. And I love the fact that you gave advice to first generation students, specifically to be persistent, keep moving forward, don't quit. Second piece of advice, merge your profession and your passion. And lastly, while you're in school, take time for self-development, because your education occurs inside and outside of the classroom. Thank you so much, Joel. It's a pleasure having you.
A special thank you to the incredible team of the Empowerment Zone. Terry Ungully, theme song. NADWORKS, digital support. And of course, our featured guest.
If you enjoyed my podcast, please subscribe. We are on all of your favorite podcast platforms. Be sure to rate us on Apple Podcasts too. Thank you for your continued support.